and welcome. You're tuned in to the best in true crime talk radio. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. Hello, Tim.
Hi.
So listen, folks, we've got some big news coming. Keep checking darknessradio.com. I know I keep telling you that week after week, but there's some big news, big changes coming to our platform. And we're very excited. We'll be giving you more information about that here very soon. But just keep checking darknessradio.com for updates. And we got some good stuff going. Now, today, Tim, we have... I wanted to kind of buffer the show. Usually when we do some shows that are kind of heavy, we skip the dumb crime, stupid criminals.
Right.
And that's because just out of respect for our guest, it's hard to come off of a very dark or emotional story and go right into being lighthearted. But what we're going to try to do is in these cases, we'll do the dumb crime, stupid criminals first and then roll into our guest so that we don't short our listeners one of their favorite segments of the show. So when we can, we're going to do it this way, which is what we're going to do today. In a little bit, we're going to be joined by our guest. We're going to talk about his book, Why, Gary, Why. Jody Plachet will join us, and it's an amazing story. I remember watching this unfold as it happened. So we'll talk about this story in a few minutes, but let's get to some dumb crime, stupid criminals. What do you think?
I'm all tongue-tied and for it.
All right. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's time now for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals.
It's Crayon News story time.
What happened with this dude, Christ Bearer? I heard he cut his penis off and then jumped off a balcony.
Suspect pulls gun from butt, shoots twice at Denver police.
What is your emergency?
I need help.
And what's the problem?
I'm too high.
You're too high?
Yeah.
All right, our first story, Tim. Of all reasons, what would be, if you had to pick the top two reasons to close down a strip joint, what do you think that would be? What would be the reasons for closing down a strip joint that would make sense to you?
Well, Dave, they're going to, for me, surround health violations. I would say probably something having to do with the buffet. And I would just say overall cleanliness.
Okay, so cleanliness and health infractions. Right. First of all, I didn't, you know, it's been a long time since I've been to a strip joint. Mm-hmm. And usually I go at night. I've never been to a strip joint with a buffet, Tim.
No?
No. What do they, how do they?
It's a lot of finger food.
Oh, gross.
No, really? No, I'm just saying it is. It's a lot of finger food. It is. It's like wings and stuff like that.
Well, here we go. A strip club in Dayton, Ohio, bit off a little bit more than they could chew after losing its liquor license following an investigation that proved it allowed customers to use food stamps to buy lap dances and drugs.
No.
Food stamps. During their... I'm just picturing the dancers working, doing what they do, and then the guy just tucking a book of food stamps into their G-string. What? What? It's so bizarre. During their 5-month investigation, Ohio, I love how they stretched it into 5 months. You know, we're not sure we have enough, we have enough to go on yet. So we're just going to keep staking out the strip joint. I need another $32,000 in food stamps, boss. Can you help us out? During their 5-month investigation, Ohio undercover agents used over $2,400 in food stamps to buy the dances, along with a variety of drugs, including cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl. According to reports, the Ohio Investigative Unit began the investigation into 2250 Inc., also known as Sharky's Bar, back in May of 2017, officially closing the adult entertainment establishment on Thursday, September 20th. Criminal charges were filed against patrons and employees for drug trafficking, food stamp trafficking, distribution of heroin, aggravated shipment, engaging in a pattern of corrupt activity, and illegal sexual activity. Agents also filed 44 charges that were headed by the Liquor Control Commission, including drug sale, drug possession, engaging in sexual activity, solicitation, and food stamp trafficking. It remains unclear how the strip club was able to pull off its food stamp hustle. Dude, that's got to be the name of our next album.
Food stamp hustle. Yeah, yeah. It's catchy.
Yeah, Dave and the Heartbeats. Food stamp hustle. Or how they got a food stamp machine to begin with. This is the second entertainment establishment liquor permit that has been revoked by the Liquor Control Commission due to an investigation by the Ohio Investigating Unit dealing with food stamps and drug trafficking. The other location, the Harem, lost its liquor license in May of 2018 and was ordered to close for 12 months after the judge granted a preliminary injunction after a nine-month-long investigation. Well, 9 months to bust that strip joint, Tim.
I'm stuck on one detail in this whole story, and that is heroin and fentanyl. Who wants a sleepy stripper?
Right. I'm still baffled by the fact that they're negotiating with food stamps. Oh, my God. All right. Now, here's a great follow-up to that. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
The story is not humorous, folks. The headline cracks me up coming off of what we just did. It's actually a horrific story, so I apologize up front for laughing right now. But a man aged 48 admits to running a prostitution ring out of a sex dungeon in his parents' basement.
Oh, no. How do you get permission from mom and dad on that deal?
Mom, knock. You can't just walk in, Mom. I'm trying to run a business, Mom.
Mom, there's a sock on the knob for a reason.
Well, I just made some finger sandwiches for you and your friends. This is where the story goes off the rails. Obviously, the opening is funny, right? Man, 48 admits to running a prostitution ring out of a sex dungeon in his parents' basement. This is where the rest gets darker, where he kept 20 women plied with crack cocaine and heroin. So, as I said, I don't mean to laugh. It's just the idea of somebody running a sex ring out of their mom's basement, calling it a sex dungeon. It's so bizarre. A Long Island man has pleaded guilty to sex trafficking and prostitution charges after admitting that 4 years he operated a brothel out of his parents' basement where women were plied with crack cocaine and heroin. Raymond Rodeo III, age 48, from South Beach, New York, on Tuesday, pleaded guilty to multiple felony counts of sex trafficking, criminal sale of a controlled substance, and promoting prostitution, all of which is not funny. I'm not laughing at what he did or the way that he treated these human beings, folks. It's just, I can't even, Jesus, my parents were bothering the hell out of me every 10 minutes playing Dungeons and Dragons with my friends in the basement. I can't even fathom how this guy went on. Rodeo is expected to be sentenced to more than 9 years in prison. Doesn't that seem kind of, I don't know.
That's a light sentence.
Very light sentence, followed by 5 years of post-release supervision when he goes before a judge on March 9th. He will also be required to register as a sex offender. Oh, my God.
You just see the parents sitting upstairs and you hear the old man going, Margaret, I'm going to have to replace the pipes again. I hear nothing but moaning and groaning.
That's right. According to Suffolk County District Court, District Attorney's Office, in August of 2018, police pulled over Rodeo after a routine traffic stop, discovering a suspected victim of human trafficking in his car. Mm-hmm. A subsequent investigation uncovered that the woman had been forced into prostitution by Rodeo in the spring of 2018. Further investigation by the Suffolk Police Human Trafficking Investigations Unit and the District Attorney's Office Human Trafficking Team revealed that Rodeo was trafficking women out of the basement of his parents' home on Lower Rocky Point Road in South Beach since December 2014. Suffolk County District Attorney Tim Sini said Rodeo used social media to lure some 22 women in their 20s, got them addicted to heroin and crack cocaine by initially offering them drugs free of charge, then force them to have sex for money. This guy's a horrific human being, and my congratulations to the cops for breaking this ring and stopping this.
Yeah, yeah.
It's completely insane. According to officials, the women were locked for extended periods of time in Rodeo's makeshift sex dungeon in the basement, which did not have a shower or a toilet.
Oh.
They were forced to relieve themselves in a bucket. None of the women that Rodeo had preyed upon have been arrested in connection with the prostitution case. They will all be receiving counseling. Thank God.
Yeah.
Thank God. And our prayers and thoughts go out to every one of these women and their families. And thank God that they're alive and safe. Now, here's where it goes crazy again. Prosecutors said Rodeo's parents, both age 74, were not aware of what was going on in their home. The door to the basement has an exterior lock to which Rodeo had the only key, a press release from the district attorney's office stated. In addition to the house, Rodeo also allegedly forced the victims to perform prostitution at various motels throughout Suffolk County. Rodeo's mother, Nancy, denied that her son had used her basement as a brothel. There was nothing going on in my house, she said. Rodeo's father, Raymond Rodeo Jr., said his son has battled drug addiction for many years. The elder Rodeo said he tried to get his son help, but his efforts failed. Rodeo III has a son and a daughter of his own. In November 2015, his name appeared on Suffolk County's non-paying parents list, revealing that he owed more than $50,000 in child support payments. This is the epitome of a dumb crime and stupid criminal.
Yeah.
How are you not aware that this is going on in your house?
I can't imagine that they didn't know that something was going on. I mean,
crazy.
Yeah.
Huh. All right. A couple more stories here, Tim. Oh, this is tragic. A man accidentally killed his neighbor with a crossbow while trying to save that neighbor from a dog attack. We're going to Massachusetts for this story, where a Massachusetts man attempting to save his neighbor from a dog attack accidentally shot and killed him with a crossbow, officials said. Police are investigating the incident as an accidental death, according to a release from the Berkshire District Attorney's Office. Police from Adams received multiple 911 calls Wednesday at approximately 12:09 for a reported mauling in progress. Investigators believe that the man, described as a Good Samaritan by the District Attorney's Office, heard a commotion coming from his neighbor's apartment, rushed over to help. The man retrieved a crossbow and shot at one of the pit bulls. Investigators believe that the bolt struck one of the dogs, went through the door, and fatally struck the neighbor, who was attempting to barricade himself from the attack. He was identified as Joshua Jodasing, age 27. Responding officers had to use their service weapons to neutralize the animals, who have a history of being aggressive, and turn the attack on that responding officers. One of the dogs, named Max, previously attacked someone in the home in 2018 and was and the unidentified victim had to receive medical care. District Attorney Andrea Harrington said at a news conference, it's believed that the dogs were owned by he and his partner. The ballistics portion of the incident is still under investigation, according to the release. Now, this isn't really dumb crime, stupid criminals, but just a story that is unbelievable.
Yeah.
Just in the headline alone. I mean, what a tragedy. You're trying to help save this guy and end up taking his life. Oh,
yeah.
So we're back on track with this crazy ass story. All right. Mm-hmm. Police called after an Oklahoma neighbor's battle with feces, guns, and a Roomba vacuum cleaner, Tim. A dispute between two neighbors escalated to the point where one tried to smash down the fence separating their property with a robot vacuum cleaner. Doom, 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 doom.
I don't trust him.
Doom, 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 doom.
I really do.
KFOR, the four, reported that John Stafford was taken into custody February 5th after a nearly 12-hour standoff with neighbor David Baird that ended up with the police using tear gas to force Stafford from his home. According to Baird, Stafford became upset with him from an unknown reason and began attacking their shared fence with a Roomba vacuum in an attempt to bring it down. Baird went inside and grabbed his handgun and tried to use it to dissuade his neighbor from doing any more damage. Boy, you don't bring a Roomba to a gunfight, Tim.
No, you don't, no.
Baird told the station, I told him, if you break through the fence, I'm going to shoot you. He made his wife and kids stay inside while Stafford threw dog poop into their yard from his driveway and hit the fence with the vacuum. What in God's green earth could, how much do you hate your neighbor that you're flinging dog poop at him and then bashing down his fence with a Roomba?
Oh my God.
Both Baird and his other neighbors videotaped the incident. Police eventually sent a SWAT team to the neighborhood, complete with a bomb squad and an explosive retrieval robot. Doom, 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 doom. Doom, 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 doom. Stafford eventually went inside his house, dialing 911. When he contacted a dispatcher, Stafford told them that he wanted a report, or he wanted to report a douchebag, and then spelled the word out when asked to speak like an adult. He also told the dispatcher he was going to run you guys into the ground. Stafford proceeded to call 911 five additional times.
Wow.
Baird said that he'd never had a problem with his neighbor before. He still doesn't know what prompted Stafford's outburst. After exchanging words with Stafford, police eventually deployed tear gas canisters to force him out of his home so they could take him into custody. Stafford is in custody at the Oklahoma County Jail on a charge of planning an act of violence. If convicted, he could serve a sentence. All right, check this out.
Okay.
He could serve a sentence of up to 10 years in prison.
What?
For throwing poop and bashing a fence with a Roomba. The other guy ran a brothel with 22 women, sex trafficking, addicted to crack cocaine, prostitution ring from his parents' basement. He's going to get 9 years? This guy's going to get 10 years for flinging poop and bashing a gate with a Roomba.
Oh.
The balance of nature is out of whack. I sense a great disturbance in the forest, Tim.
I guess so, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here you go, though, Tim. Are you ready?
Doom, 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 doom.
Doom, 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 doom. For those of you that don't know, that is the Terminator theme. Robotic vacuums, Tim, have been implicated in unexplained violence before.
See?
Doom, 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 doom. In 2015, the Daily Dot reported that a 52-year-old South Korean woman was asleep on the floor when she woke up to discover that her automated cleaner had made its way over to her and began sucking in her hair.
Uh-huh.
She was unable to extricate herself from the robot, so she called the fire department. They came to her home and managed to get her hair untangled without any further damage to her or the machine. Doom, 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 doom. I think that's two totally different scenarios. They're kind of comparing apples to Volkswagens here, Tim.
I don't think so, but that's just me. Yeah.
Good God. Well, first of all, if you have a Roomba and long hair, don't be napping on the floor.
But yeah. Dave, it's America. You have the right to nap on your floor if you'd like.
I guess. Yeah. I guess. A northeastern Pennsylvania woman drove into oncoming traffic as a test of faith. A northeast Pennsylvania woman drove into a path of an oncoming vehicle as a way to test her faith, then exhibited no concern about the people who were injured in the crash, according to the state police. Bail was revoked this week for 31-year-old Nadija Riley of Drums in Luzerne County. She is charged with aggravated assault and other offenses over allegations that she purposely caused the wreck on Route 93 near Weatherly, about 45 miles north of Allentown. Back on January 7th, an investigator said Riley told him she had been driving around for a few hours waiting for a calling from God when she decided to drive through the oncoming vehicle. Riley related, God took care of her by not having her injured, wrote Trooper Bruce Bellet in an arrest affidavit. Riley expressed no concern or remorse for the victims. Riley also stated she did not care if the other people were injured because God would have taken care of them. Two people in the other vehicle were taken to the hospital for treatment of injuries, Ballet wrote. The online court docket indicated her $50,000 bail was revoked as of Wednesday. Her lawyer, Andrew Thielen Bench, filed a notice with the court that Riley plans to waive her formal arraignment in Carbon County Court. He declined comment to go on the record this Friday. Prosecutor Seth Eric Miller did not return a message seeking comment either. What the hell is wrong with people?
Yeah, yeah. I have no words.
All right, our final dumb crime, stupid criminal story.
Mm-hmm.
Woman gets mother-in-law killed with a snake bite after she causes problem in an extramarital affair. The news of a woman's killing her mother-in-law with a snake bite has come to light. This incident took place in a village in the Junjahunjahujigao district of Rajasthan.
Ah.
The daughter-in-law, Alfana, had an extramarital affair with Jaipur resident Manish. Alfana Manish and his friend Krishna Kumar were recently arrested for the murder of Subdo Devi. Alfana and her mother-in-law, Subdo Devi, used to live together in the village. Alfana's husband, Sahin, and his brother, Sharatan, served the Indian Army, so they were deployed outside. Subdo Devi's husband, Rajesh, also used to live away because of his service. Sahin and Alfana got married on December 12th of 2018. While her husband was away, Alfana had an extramarital affair with Manish. They used to be on call quite often, which is when Subdo Devi got a whiff of the affair and started taunting her for always being on the phone. After her mother-in-law started becoming a hindrance in her love story, Alfana and her lover, Manish, planned to get Subdo Devi killed in a way that could not be traced back to them. So back in June 2019, they killed Subdo Devi with a snake bite. However, after 1.5 months of her death, Alfana's in-laws had suspicions about her and filed a police complaint. They even provided some concrete proof. The family gave police telephone numbers of Alfana and Manish. On June 2nd, there were 124 calls between the two numbers, and 19 calls were made between Alfana and Krishna Kumar. Some messages were also shared between these numbers. The police completed the case and found that Alfana, Manish, and his friend Krishna Kumar were guilty of Subdo Devi's murder, and they were arrested in January of 2020. Mm. How insane is that?
Completely.
Yeah. Meanwhile, a 10-year-old boy was asked to remove his T-shirt on a New Zealand flight. Why, Tim? Because it had a picture of a snake on it. Uh-huh. Yeah. 10-year-old boy Stevie Lucas, traveling from Johannesburg to New Zealand, was recently forced to change his shirt at the airport because it had a snake printed on it. According to the report by The Independent, the boy's family claims that he was forced to change his shirt before boarding the plane because authorities claim that it could cause anxiety to other passengers. I agree. I would have thrown the kid and his shirt off the plane, duct taped him to the wing, and allowed him to ride that way. The T-shirt is terrifying. It looks like a real snake hanging over his shoulder. It's so beautifully detailed.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
The news was shared on Twitter by a page called Aviation Fail with a caption, "A boy, 10, is forced to take his shirt off before boarding a plane from New Zealand to South Africa because it had a picture of a reptile on it." Not a reptile. It's not a cute gecko, Tim. It's not the gecko.
No.
No. Hmm. A boy, 10, forced to take off his shirt because of a snake on it. Stevie was visiting his grandparents in South Africa, and when he arrived at the OR Tambo Airport, the said incident took place. The boy was wearing a black tee which featured a large green venomous snake printed on it. And when the authorities saw it, they declared that it was not proper clothing to be worn on board a flight, reports said. According to Daily Mail, Stevie's parents, Steve and Marga, revealed that when security officers saw the shirt, they started telling them about rules pertaining to snake toys and clothing. That Samuel L. Jackson has messed up a lot of people, Tim.
Yeah, he has. Yep.
Tired of these snake T-shirts on this plane.
Mm-hmm.
In order to sort out the situation, the parents of the boy then asked him to wear his T-shirt inside out. In fact, airport security footage also shows Stevie taking off his shirt and having to turn it inside out. Thank God that crime was thwarted, Tim. All right. Well, that's it this week for Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. All right, Tim, this story that we're about to explore, I remember unfolding. As a matter of fact, I remember watching the news when footage of this story and the aftermath took place. And it deeply impacted me. As a matter of fact, I think we've referenced it over the 8 years of doing this show. I think I've referenced it on a few occasions when talking about, I can't even fathom having something happen to my child and how I would respond. And this story is always the one that comes to mind because I could see myself in this father's shoes, and wanting to do the same thing. but I've always wanted to know more of the story. I've always liked to get behind this and try to understand a little bit more about what was going on, the process behind it. And our guest today is Jody Plouchet. He has a book out called Why, Gary, Why? The Jody Plouchet Story. And Jody, thank you so much for coming on to share your story with us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
This is a very sensitive story. So for listeners, again, we like to be upfront in talking. Again, this is a true crime program and something that I think before you allow your kids to listen to, it's important for you to listen to all of this first and then determine if this is something you want them to hear. I think the message and the story behind it is important, but you might be better off sharing that angle personally. But I just want to put that at the beginning of this interview so that our listeners are prepared for your tale and what occurred. Was it difficult, Jody, to put pen to paper and document this story and kind of get it out, or was it cathartic for you to finally kind of purge all of this and put it out there?
Well, let me first by saying that I'm not sensitive, so feel free to ask me any question. It was neither. It was not cathartic, and it wasn't difficult. By the time I got to the point where I started to write the book, I had already gone through and worked through all whatever issues I would have. So to me, it was about sending a message to let people know that you can go through something as horrible as what I went through and still come out on the other side and be okay with the proper support. And I wanted to include, and that's why it took me so long to do it, is I wanted to include valuable information for parents so that they can try to prevent that from happening to their children. Now, I say that, but we haven't gotten to what that is, but that's pretty much what my book is about.
Well, the title comes from a poignant question cried out to your father at a very integral moment during this story. And we'll get to that in a little bit. But introduce me before we get into what happened to you, and your family. Talk to me a little bit about this prior to the incident that changed your life forever. What was your family like?
Our family was like any other middle-class family in South Louisiana. You know, my dad was a heavy equipment salesman. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. I had an older brother, a younger brother. My sister was the youngest. And we would go to football. We'd go to school. Then after school, we'd have, football practice. So when it was basketball season, we'd have basketball practice. When it was softball season or baseball season, we'd have baseball practice. And spring and fall, we had soccer practice. And my dad was a coach on all of our teams, so he was always around the kids. He actually, and it's a shame because he actually refused promotions at his work that may have sent him out of town a couple days a week just so he could stay at home and be with the family and coach the kids and be around them, because that's what he wanted to do. He was, like I said, he was a heavy equipment salesman. So he'd wake up, he'd go to lunch, he'd entertain clients, he'd stop by the office, fill out a little paperwork, and for the afternoon, he would go entertain clients. So basically, his job was to, go out and drink with his friends.
And were you a close family?
I would say we were. I mean, like I said, he was home every night. Mm-hmm. My mother kind of kept his drinking, held everything together despite the fact that, he drank all day, every day. But, he wasn't a violent drunk. He wasn't an angry drunk. He was a happy drunk. I didn't drink until I graduated from college. And even though he knew I didn't drink when I was in college, every time I went and met him out, he'd be like, "You want a drink?" And I'm like, "No, Daddy, I don't drink." So, I mean, he was, that was his job, was to entertain people. So everybody loved my father. He knew everybody.
Well, what do you, it's so hard to kind of jump into the story because it is a sensitive story, but you have this great family, you have this nice family life, obviously a father that cares greatly about you and mother. They decide what at one point, you know, hey, let's get the boys involved in something. Let's get them involved in karate.
Well, the crazy thing about this whole part of the story is that I was already playing football, basketball, baseball, and soccer. So I was in four sports, and I was in fifth grade, and I got a flyer from school that said, you know, take karate lessons, you know, whatever, for 10 lessons. And that piece of paper did not make it out of the classroom. I threw it in the waste paper basket as I walked out of the door. All right, this was when I was in fifth grade. Well, my little brother was a couple grades behind me. He went to a different school, but they gave him the same piece of paper. So my mother thought it would be a good idea to put my little brother into karate because he wasn't into sports. He didn't play none of it. So she thought, oh, maybe this is something he can do. So when she enrolled him, she enrolled my older brother, me, and a neighbor down the street enrolled her son. So it was the four of us that got enrolled into karate. And at the time, like I said, I didn't care to take no karate. I was already involved in other sports. And that's how I ended up taking karate.
And getting involved in this, I mean, you know, even though it wasn't something necessarily that you were excited about doing, you went along. Was this something, did you say that your other family members joined in as well? Or was this really just something you ended up focusing on?
It was me, my older brother, my younger brother, and the neighbor kid.
What was that like to begin with? You know, was it just a normal class? Did you ever feel singled out?
Here's the other funny part of the story. So we go and we take like our first lesson. The instructor, his name was Rick. Well, we go to take our second lesson. Rick never shows up. So apparently Rick was like some kind of con artist who took the money and left. And so the school was kind of left hanging like, okay, we don't know what to do. So that's when they turned the list of people, their names over to a karate instructor named Jeff Doucette, who was 23 at the time. He was just opening up his studio and was looking for students. And so he called our parents and said that he would honor the commitment that they had given to the other person. So I think we had like 9 more lessons left. He said that he would do it for free and we could come finish up the karate program. So that's how we ended up taking karate from Jeff Doucette. So literally I threw the paper away, Rick split, and all of a sudden now we're with Jeff Doucette.
And what would you, or how would you characterize Jeff Doucette when you first met him and started taking lessons with him?
I would characterize him like any other, or like a lot of, or most child molesters, pedophiles. He was very charismatic, charming, funny, witty, enthusiastic, and fun to be around. He seemed like a very awesome guy.
And you never got like a strange vibe from him or any kind of sense that this guy might be off balanced in any way?
Well, eventually I did, but no, not right. Not from the surface. From the surface, absolutely not. Absolutely, he came off as like a really awesome guy. And that's part of the grooming process, is to make themselves seem like they're larger than life, better than, you know, believable, and just a really great person, great guy, someone fun to be around. And at first, and to others, he was that. So let's say there's, you know, 8 to 10 kids that are taking karate and we're going to movies, malls, skating rinks, and having fun. Well, he'd only molest, you know, 1 or 2 of the kids. So the other 8 kids are thinking this guy's awesome and fantastic and would probably even defend him if need be, because he never did anything to them. But to the few of us that he was molesting, yeah, we knew he was off.
Right. Well, obviously, once that began, you knew. How long into working with him and taking these lessons was it before the abuse began?
It was a couple months, and the first thing that he did was test the boundaries, okay? Because that's what pedophiles do, is they test the boundaries. And testing the boundary is when they do an innocent behavior that allows them to kind of, like, for example, he would tell us we needed to stretch, and we'd have to do a split so we could make our kicks for karate. And so he'd put us up on a weight bench, and he'd give us cardboard to put on our feet and make our split our legs out. And that allowed him to put his hands on my inner thigh and be like, okay, it's tight up in here. You got to make sure you stretch. And that was seemed normal. It seemed like it was behavior that should have been done because I felt like I had to stretch. But it also allowed him to put his hands closer to my private parts than he should have at any point. But it didn't seem unnormal, or it didn't seem uncomfortable. And if I would have felt uncomfortable, he could have justified it and be like, oh, well, we were just stretching. Then I would drive the car. And this is something that they do. I was watching some special on Jerry Sandusky, and victim one was talking about how Jeff then put his hands in my lap. And now he's touching my private parts. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, does he know his hands are there? And it's also like another thing pedophiles will do is tickle. And that's why I don't like ticklers. Ticklers make me mad, because it's innocent behavior where they can easily justify accidentally touching some area they shouldn't be touching. And if the child says anything, then they move on to another child who they feel that won't say anything. And that's kind of what Jeff did. And so I would say that started, you know, like I said, a couple months earlier. And it wasn't until, you know, I guess I passed all these tests that he moved on and actually eventually came to perform oral sex on me. And a month later, that was April of 83. And then in May of 83, he actually started having sex with me.
Now, this first instance where he puts his, you know, goes from maybe just helping you limber up and touching you in ways don't seem totally inappropriate for the work you're doing and the stretching techniques. But then to just put his hands in your lap, was it just as simple as setting his hands there, or was he, and I'm not trying to get too graphic, I'm just trying for our listeners' sake and understanding, you know, was he trying to stimulate you, or was it just like, you know, again, testing the boundaries? If I put my hand here, we'll see how it goes.
Okay. First, it was like he'd rest his hands in my lap, and then he might rub, you know, one or two times and then move his hands. So, yeah, it was stimulating, but then it was gone. And so it was only enough to where it would make me think I was wrong. Like, I was confused, thinking, like, does he know his hands in my lap? Oh, okay, that must have been a mistake. And so I had this internal dialogue that's like, okay, his hands are in my lap. Oh, wait, they're gone. Okay, so maybe it was an accident. But it wasn't. It was, I mean, looking back, he was clearly
all testing calculated.
Yeah,
right.
It's all calculated.
In these situations, I mean, and how old are you again at this point?
Ooh, I was 10.
10 years old.
Actually, hold on. Let me go back. At this point, when he's starting to test the boundaries, I'm 9. I didn't turn 10 until after he started performing oral sex on me by about a week, because it was right before my birthday. And then I was 10 from the until the shooting, which I jumped a little ahead, but we'll get to that. But until the kidnapping.
All right. So, you know, I mean, are you aware, or are any of the other kids in your group being molested at the same time?
Yes. Well, actually, I'll say yes, because I witnessed it. I saw him, like, one night he wanted me to perform oral sex on him, and I told him I wasn't going to do it. He told me, if you don't do it, I'll get so-and-so to do it. I was like, well, get so-and-so to do it. So he got so-and-so to do it. And what had happened was the so-and-so was like a year older than me, and he had kind of aged out. Like, you know, pedophiles, they have a certain age that they like prepubescent children. And the other guy had gone through puberty. So even though he was still available for what he wanted, that wasn't his main attraction. His main attraction was prepubescent, and that was me. And me and my brother, we don't talk about it all the time, but we've mentioned over the years that he, you know, my little brother probably was next because he was younger, and you know, Jeff could have easily manipulated him like he did me.
Now you get further along, and how does it even get to the position where you're able to, you know, he's able to even get you alone to perform oral sex? I mean, you're in a class setting, you're doing these things. So kind of walk us through that.
I think about the movie, The Karate Kid, when they're fighting in the tournament at the end. So Jeff had what was called his fighting team. So he was teaching karate. Let's say you had 30 people in the karate class. Well, he had like 8 to 10 boys that he would take to karate tournaments, to Houston, to New Orleans. And he would get them all in a van, drive down there. He'd get, he would get adjoining rooms with 2 beds. So you had like 4 beds, and you had, you know, kids in one room, kids and him in another room. And the first time he performed oral sex on me was at a karate tournament in Houston. And there were 3 other kids in the bed. So we were all alone.
So wait, so you were sleeping in the same bed with 3 other kids and your karate instructor?
It may have been 4 of us in the bed. So it may have been me, Jeff, so-and-so, and another kid. And then you had another bed with 4 other kids. Then you had another room with other kids in it. So, I mean, we're all connected, but they're all sleeping. It's, you know, after midnight, TV's off, and he just went under the covers and started performing oral sex on me. I didn't know why he wanted to do it.
So did he, I mean, in some of the interviews that I've seen, you mentioned that he kind of told you, he was leading you up to tell you that he was going to start doing these things. Is that right?
All right. So by the time he told me that, hey, I'm going to do this to you tonight, he had already been rubbing me, masturbating me. So he'd already been touching me and feeling on me. So this wasn't just like out of the blue. It wasn't like one day he's like, hey, I'm just going to do this. So it was a kind of a gradual progression. And with the touching, and I remember we were going crawfishing, and we were, again, we were four of us in one bed, 4 in another. And, you know, Jeff's got me on the outside so he can kind of build a wall. He could turn his back and build a wall to the other kids. And he's reaching around and he's rubbing on me. And he did that all night. Like, he just wouldn't leave me alone. And it drove me crazy. And so we went to the crawfish bowl, and he said, like, you haven't said anything about what I do. And because I was pretending to be sleeping, so I was pretending I didn't know what he was doing, I said, I don't know what you're talking about. And I think that at that moment, that's when I passed that test. That's when he's like, okay, I got this kid.
And in touching you, I mean, as a kid, how are you processing this? You know, was it just like, you know, was it like you were trying to understand what was going on, or did you ever feel threatened by these kind of touches? And I know this sounds strange for our listeners, but to understand how molestation begins for a lot of children, you know, on the outside, it's all easy for us to go, oh, if somebody touched me, I would have been, and I would have done, and I would have said. But a lot of us have never been in that position and have no real concept of how this begins or how a child becomes a victim, not once, but multiple times. When he began touching you, were you reluctant? Did you tell him, no, stop? How did that start?
No, I just, you know, I'm 10 years old. Or shit, like I said, I was 9 years old. So remember, though, the backdrop of this is we're going to the movies. We're going to Chuck E. Cheese. We're going to Astroworld. We're traveling to Houston. We're going to these karate tournaments. So all this is taking place, and then you have that taking place. So it was kind of like, okay, Jeff's like this really fun guy. He's really awesome to be around, but he does this too. And that was kind of like a little part of it. Like, it didn't happen that long. Like, I mean, it was just easier to be quiet and not to say anything because, like I tell people, I knew my dad would kill him if I said anything. And, you know, we know what happened.
Well, and were you, in essence, were you attracted to him?
No.
You know, okay.
I never once was like, hey, Jeff, you know what? Hook me up. No, this was not something where I was attracted to him. I didn't like it. Despite, and I bring this up in the book, you know, like he's performing oral sex on me, despite my body responding like a human body does and the physiological response my body did, I never once wanted him to touch me in any way. So
did you tell him to stop?
No, I would have never told him to stop. Keep in the background, he's this karate guy who, you know, can beat you up and pin you down. So you have that kind of fear, that respect, that, you know, he's fun. So you have all this factoring in, kind of like, you know, when you scuba dive and all that pressure from the water coming down on you, all that's going on. So it's not in a vacuum. It's not like, you know, I went to karate one day and he was like, hey, come here, boop, and try to perform oral sex on me. And I was like, oh, wait, stop. Think of a battered woman. The husband or the boyfriend that beats up his girlfriend, they're not a jerk on the first date, or they'd never get a second date. It's not until they get you wrapped around their finger or they get you comfortable and liking being around them that they start trying to control you. And that's kind of exactly what he did.
So it was this slow kind of ingratiating himself into you, but did he ever physically threaten or impose on you, making you feel like if you didn't go along with it, there would be repercussions? Or do you think that was just more your perception of, I just don't want to disappoint this guy?
No, he never, I would say, physically threatened me. Now, fast forward a year into this, or right before the kidnapping, there were other stuff going on, and my parents were separated at this point, and, you know, he would get jealous if I would spend time with my dad. So he kind of was like, oh, you love your dad more than me. And he would throw guilt trips and manipulation, but that was later. We're talking in the beginning of the relationship. No, never did he threaten me. He never said, if I tell, I'd kill my cat. You know, nothing like that. It was just, he used the trust, the, I don't want to say affection, but the admiral, like, just as a kid, you look up to older people, and, you know, he would give us money. We'd go to the mall. We, like I said, we'd go to a skating rink, and he used all that, the fact that we thought he was this great, fun guy. That's what he used to keep us quiet.
And in this first instance, when he, you know, when you guys were all sharing the bed and he just suddenly goes under the covers and takes advantage of you through this, I mean, just the balls on this guy that he does it in a bed with two other boys there. Do you know if these other boys were victims of his as well?
I know the one on the other side of him, the one closest to him, was absolutely. He's the so-and-so I talked about earlier.
Gotcha. And once you know, that glass ceiling has been broken and this has occurred, I mean, again, are you talking to any of the other kids in your group? And, you know, are you guys aware of each other and what's happening to one another?
Not at first. It wasn't until maybe 6 months later that he got this idea to, well, no, it was probably the night that he wanted me to perform oral sex on him, and he said if I don't do it, he'll get the other kid to do it, and then the other kid did it, that I was aware that there were any other kids. And one time, he actually was having sex, but he's raping me.
Right.
And the other kid was in the bathroom. And when he left, and there were other kids in the hotel room, this was a hotel room, when he went out of the bathroom, the other kid looked at me and said, it hurts, doesn't it? So that's kind of what I knew for a certainty that he had been doing him too.
The question then everybody starts to get into is, why wouldn't one of you come forward and tell an adult?
That's a tough thing to tell your parent. Right. And as a 10-year-old or an 11-year-old, I actually never told. What happened was, after they rescued me in California, they took me to the hospital.
Hold on. We'll come back to that. I don't want to jump that far ahead. I just was wondering at that moment, you know, because again, as a parent, you know, I've got a lot of children, and I've always told my children, if anybody does this ever, you tell me immediately. And I have altered one thing in you brought up the fact that you were afraid to tell your father because you knew he'd kill this guy or felt that he would. I changed my way of speaking to my children because of a past guest we had on the show as well, because I didn't want my children fearing for my safety. I said, you know, I've warned my children, if anything happens, you can always come to me. If they tell you that if you tell me they're going to kill me or somebody else in our family, it's a lie. That's their way of manipulating you. But you come to me and we will legally handle this and stop this so it doesn't happen to other kids. My original answers used to be, I'll kill him. They'll never find the body. And then this former guest of ours said, that's one of the worst things you could ever say, because now your kid begins worrying about your safety and worrying about you going to jail, and they don't want to tell you because of that. And that concept had never crossed my mind. You want to make it feel like you're a superhero to your kid and that you'll handle it and that you'll erase this scum for doing these things. But that actually is detrimental to the child.
Absolutely. Do you remember who that guest was? Because the reason why I say that is because I point that out and I stress that out in my book. Like, by saying that, that's counter to what you want. You're letting your child know that you're capable of committing the crime, and your kid's going to not say anything to you because they don't want you to go to jail.
Right. And I don't, unfortunately, remember. We've been doing true crime for 8 or 9 years, at least once a week, and hundreds of victims and people have told us this through the years, so I can't respond specifically to who told me. But Tim, do you remember by any chance?
I do not know.
Right.
I'll tell you what, I will agree with that person, because I stress that in the book.
All right. That's great. And folks, listen to that. Don't ever, I know you want to feel like you're protecting your child and you want them to feel safe, but that can actually work the opposite way by making them more fearful for your safety and that you might end up in jail. And it becomes even more of a reason for your children to hide these things from.
Throw in the factor that normally the person who's committing this crime is a known trusted adult to the parents. Like, Jeff was welcomed kind of as a family member. He would come over on family night. He'd stay on the couch. There's a scene in, I don't know if you saw the ESPN E60, where they talked to my uncle, and my uncle, we were at a karate tournament in Fort Worth, and we were going to go stay with my uncle in Dallas, and we met up with my uncle so Jeff could drop us off, and as I got out of the van, Jeff, like, I guess gave me a kiss on the mouth. I don't even remember it, and my uncle saw that and was like, he went to my dad and was like, something's not right with this relationship. He kissed him on the mouth. Like, I don't kiss my kids on the mouth. And my dad was like, no, you just, Jeff is nice. You just don't understand. So by the time it got to the point where other people were seeing things that might not be right, my parents were so used to him, it didn't seem out of the ordinary. And so you factor in that this is probably an uncle or a cousin or a family member or your dad's best friend that's doing this, that's another factor that makes the child not want the parent to go kill this person.
Right. It's a strange protective maneuver. Your parents, in hindsight, after all of this occurred, did they see things that, you know, in hindsight, they could say, God, yeah, I saw that. I don't know why that didn't set off an alarm.
Well, in 1983, it wasn't talked about. So, okay. In hindsight, no. Absolutely, because I quit I quit all the sports I was involved in because Jeff made me. So I quit playing football, quit playing basketball, quit playing soccer, quit playing, and only focused on karate. My personality changed. You know, I would always go play with the kids, and I would sit at the table with the grownups, and we'd play games, and it eventually led to Trivial Pursuit, but it used to be a game called Password that they would play. And after Jeff, I would go sit in a room next to him. He wouldn't let me play. He wouldn't let me go anywhere. So I always had to sit next to him and watch TV. And so my whole personality changed. I quit playing sports. So looking back, it's like, yeah, it's kind of weird that I acted like this. But at the time, they didn't know because, again, you didn't have programs like this interview or the other ones that you've done over the last 8 or 9 years that talk about it, that educate people on what to look for.
When things escalate and they go from touching to oral sex, when he first tells you, you know, we're going to have sex, did you even have a concept of what that meant?
Yes. Thankfully, I had had discussions with my mother. She used to make us watch like after school specials and TV specials. And at some point we talked about how, like gay men are romantically involved. And so I put it in my book. I knew it was my butt whenever he told me that.
So you knew what that meant. As a child, I mean, you hear somebody's planning on doing this. How did that affect you? I mean, did you just live in a constant state of fear of when that might happen?
Well, luckily, he didn't make me wait too long. I was none too pleased to hear this. But at the time, I used school as my getaway. Like, to me, school was fun because I didn't have to worry. I could be myself. It was after school when I got off the bus, when I'd go to karate, that I knew something was going to happen. And, yeah, I was never happy about going to karate. But it might be the first 10 minutes of the karate practice where he might say, okay, everyone's doing jumping jacks, and he'd have me go in the back. And while everyone – he gets another, you know, older student to lead the – calisthenics, and so you're doing jumping jacks, push-ups, sit-ups, and that's going to take 10 to 15 minutes before you start doing the karate or before he has to actually be in the room to lead the lessons. And he would make me go to the bathroom, he'd do it real quick, and then I'd get back out there. And so, yeah, I never looked forward to those few minutes.
And then it starts to turn darker. I mean, this guy goes from molesting and doing this to this kidnapping. Can you kind of walk me up to the days before the kidnapping, and were you aware of his plans or what was going on in his mind?
Okay, the saddest thing about it is, I mean, he had a sixth grade education, so he wasn't the smartest person in the world or most educated person in the world, but I don't think he was dumb. He came up with this idea that he was going to sell these mugs, commemorative mugs, for LSU football. And what it was going to be like a mason jar mug with gold writing that had the score of the LSU games on it. So, like, you know, this year would have been a great year to sell the mugs. And he was going to put pralines wrapped in purple paper, cellophane paper, in there. So you had that purple and gold effect. So you got – not only did you get the mugs, but you got a treat. And that was his idea. So he came up with it, and he was selling this mug, and people were writing him money orders and checks. Well, he didn't get permission from LSU to do this. And so LSU were like, okay, nope, you're not going to do this. So he had to refund all the money. Well, he had already spent the money. Then he came up with another idea for an LSU bandana called a tiger rag. He based it off of Pittsburgh's terrible towel. So you would have LSU fans with these bandanas. And again, it's sold really well. He ordered like let's say 500 of them. And they did a Tesla market where they sold a few of them. And so he was sold the idea to a guy who owned a convenience store. It was actually one of my dad's friends. My dad introduced him. And he was going to sell him, I want to say, 10,000 bandanas to this guy who owned a bunch of convenience stores. Well, the guy gave him the money up front to buy the bandanas and was going to give him the second payment after he delivered the bandanas. Well, again, Jeff went and spent the money, so he couldn't get the second – he couldn't get the bandanas to deliver to the guy because he had already spent the money. So all of this is coming down on him. So he owes all this money. He's trying to get it. And we're getting into the beginning of 1984 because the sales of the mugs and the bandanas was all summer and fall of 83. And he told me, he said, if I can't get the money to pay these people back, I'm going to California. And when I'm due, I'm taking you. So I knew that that cloud was kind of over my head, but I didn't know how true it was. And it wasn't until he came to the house on February 19th, 1984. He knocked on the door. My mother answered the door. He came in for a minute. He asked my mom if he could borrow her car because he had to go check on some carpet because another kid, his family was building a brand new house and his brother owned a carpet place. And he said he was going to go check on that carpet and then he'd be right back. Well, we got in the car and we didn't head towards that house. We headed to his brother's house in Gonzales, Louisiana. And I'm like, all right, where are we going? He says, we're going to my brother's house. I'm getting some stuff and we're going to California. And so he went and picked up some stuff at his brother's house. We got in the car and we headed to Port Arthur, Texas. We got there. That's where his mother and his sister lived. We stayed with his mother. That was a Sunday night. His mother called my mother Sunday night and said, yeah, Jeff and Jody are here. And my mother was like, Jeff needs to get home. Jody's got to go to school. She said, okay, they'll be home tomorrow. Monday came and went. We went, me and Jeff and his mom went to his uncle's house in Vinton, Louisiana to look, to try to borrow money to get tickets to go to California. I don't know whether he got the money or not. He got it from somewhere. And that Tuesday we left on a bus from Orange, Texas, headed to Los Angeles. And that Tuesday, my mom and sheriff's deputies went to Port Arthur looking for me. They missed us by about like maybe an hour.
Now, what are you thinking at this time? Are you realizing what's going on or are you just thinking you're on a trip?
I didn't think I was on a trip. At this point, I'm just going along with the program. I'm so brainwashed, manipulated. You know, Jeff's telling me this is what's going to happen, and I just accepted it for what it was. I was, you know, I'm going with you to California.
Did you develop feelings for this man? Do you feel like you did love him?
Yes, absolutely, and I don't shy away from that. I think that that is what child molesters use as protection. They use the emotions of the young child. That's why when I hear people go, oh, well, did he threaten you? Well, no, he didn't have to. You know, I didn't want Jeff to get in trouble. I just wanted him to quit doing what he was doing.
All right. So at no time during any of this did it become something that you looked forward to, but this was still somebody you cared about and loved. You just didn't like that aspect of who he was.
Absolutely.
So you loved him, but you weren't in love with him.
Right. I mean, okay. Kind of like your best friend. I felt like he was my best friend who had this dark side to him. If he would just quit doing that, he would have been awesome. But those two things are separate. One is because of the other.
The kidnapping is going on. You're complicit in this simply because you've just kind of brainwashed and going along for the ride. Are you ever at any point feeling like you're in danger?
No, I never once felt like I was in danger. I probably was, but I never felt like I was.
And what of, your concern for your family? Obviously you were close to your family, loved your family, and now you're on the run and on the road with this man who you know is doing some bad things, even though you have affection and friendship with him. Are you conflicted by this, or was it just, do you feel like you were just so worn down by everything that you weren't feeling anything?
I was pretty worn down. The one thing, like I said, I never felt like I was, you know, going to be harmed. And I never felt like I would be gone forever. It was a week later. So he took me on a Sunday, and the following Sunday, we had checked into the Samoa Motel in Anaheim, California, which is located a one block Disneyland. It's now called the America's Best Value Hotel at Harbor and Catella. And he said, you know what, call your mom, let her know you're okay. So I called home. My mother answered the phone. It sounded like I woke her up. She's like, hello. And I was like, hey, it's, you know, it's me. And so she went 1 week without hearing from me. And over the next couple of days, Jeff would call or I would call. And meanwhile, the police are at the house. They're recording the phone conversations. They're writing notes to my mother telling her, you know, how's the weather? Does Jody have a jacket? Because Jeff was saying we were in New York. You know, temperatures in New York were 20 degrees. We were actually in Anaheim, and the temperature in Anaheim was 60 degrees. So they're asking, you know, what's on TV, trying to get an idea of what was going on. Now, the day we arrived in Los Angeles, we took a bus. We got off the bus. We hung out in the bus station for a while. We walked around L.A. We saw him film in Hill Street Blues, this particular segment. Well, one of my mom's family friends, she called like Paramount or Universal, or she called someone and said, hey, where do y'all film Hill Street Blues? And they said Los Angeles, and some scenes are shot in Chicago. So she kind of narrowed it down to Chicago or L.A.
Great detective work. First of all, amazing that your parents are putting this together and kind of following this, and that you were able to give this kind of information. What are the odds that something like that would be happening that you could actually note and pass on to them? So once you've given them this information, how quickly is it that you're found?
Ooh, I'd have to look at the calendar. If I left on the 19th, plus 7 would be 26. It was a leap year, I think. So he was arrested at 28. So you're looking at 2 days. What happened is how they ended up catching him is he was running out of money. And he called collect. He had me call home collect. And when I called home collect, I guess this was probably the second or third collect call, my mother asked the operator, right, for those who don't know, a collect call is when you call someone long distance and they agree to pay for the charges.
Right.
And so my mother asked the operator for time and charges. And what that means is after the phone conversation's over, the operator would get back on the phone and say the call was 29 minutes and it's going to cost you $41 because, you know, long distance back then was expensive.
Right.
And so once the operator came back on to give my mother the time and the charges, that's when Mike Burnett with the Louisiana, the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department got on the phone and said, look, I'm investigating a kidnapping. I need to know exactly where that phone call came from. So instead of tracing the call, the operator was able to give them the address, the motel, and the room number.
Boom. All right. Now, he's keeping you in touch with your parents. That's kind of strange.
He was not a good kidnapper.
No. But was this so that he was trying to cover the fact of what was really going on, just how bad this was?
I think the idea of going on the run is a lot easier than actually being on the run. And I think he was tired of running because he had dyed my hair black. He had shaved his beard. He had tried to dye his hair. He was running out of money, couldn't find a job. And I just think, you know, I think he was tired and he was done with it. And I think he figured he could be able to work his way out of it.
So he was showing, you know, hey, look, we're keeping you in touch. I've never really kept him from you. We just did this. So he's trying to play that whole angle. Did they have any idea what sexually was going on between you at this point?
Not at this point.
Okay. So once they track you down, they find the hotel, they know where you're at, the police converge. Is there any kind of altercation does he give up?
He was on the phone. They knocked on the door. They opened the door. And when they came busted in, he set the phone down. He turned his back, put his hands on the wall. Police officer walked around the bed because he was furthest from the door by the wall. I was closest to the door on the bed. And they walked around the bed. And the one cop said, I'll punch you in your mouth, and walked over and hung up the phone. And then they arrested him. They took me out the room, and I never saw him again.
And that was it.
Well, that was the beginning.
No, I know. But I mean, that was it for the end of that cycle of your life. You know, when they're talking to you, does a 10-year-old even have the concept of, and I'm not trying to belittle or make it sound like you were stupid or slow, but I mean, do you even have a true concept of just how bad this whole situation is at that point?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I knew, and this is where we're jumping. We're not jumping ahead. We're to the point where I was going to jump ahead, and you told me not to jump ahead. But I knew at this point I was going to the police station, and I did. We went to the police station. I knew they were going to question me, and I answered all the questions. I minimized my lies. Like, I tried not to lie. But when it came to the question of did he ever touch you, I knew to lie. I knew I was then going to go to the hospital, which is exactly what happened. So after 2 hours of being questioned by the Anaheim Police Department, they took me to the hospital where a full rape examination was done on me. And I tell people it's a complete physical exam. They took blood. They took urine. They took cotton swab samples. And I knew eventually that that exam was going to come back with positive proof that Jeff had molested me. So I knew I didn't have to tell on him. I knew he was going to tell on himself. He was going to get himself caught for having done what he did to me. So they take me to this child's home for like neglected kids till my dad can get me a plane ticket. You know, so I was there one day. We flew out of LA at 1:10 in the morning. I arrived in New Orleans at 6 o'clock in the morning, and I got a little rest, and then they took me to the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department. And now, in 1984, you didn't have an advocate sit with you while you gave your statement to police. They put me in a room with these two cops, and they probably grilled me for 3 hours. And I told the truth. The only thing I lied about is if Jeff touched me. And after that interview was over, they told me I was going to go to jail if I was lying. I would get in trouble. They were going to take me away from my parents. I mean, they weren't nice. And when that interview was over with, they went to my parents and they said, we've been interviewing children for years. They said, either that man didn't touch him or he's so brainwashed he'd never admit it. And they were wrong on both statements.
That's unbelievable to me that they're taking a victim and mentally torturing you, making you fear for yourself. No wonder kids don't come forward.
Well, they weren't stupid. They knew what had happened.
Right, but still, by threatening you and that they're going to take you away from your family and that you're going to go to jail if you're lying, I mean, that's just, I know that they were, the ends in their eyes justified the means. They needed that admission from you. But it just seems like, boy, what a, this kid has already been through so much, and then they're going to just heap that onto you. How are you feeling during that interrogation?
I was trying to keep my composure. I knew that they were going to be looking for me to squirm. And what I did was I kept rubbing my big toe in my shoe. And I knew that they couldn't see that. And I just kept it at the same pace, just stroking my big toe, stroking my big toe, stroking my big toe. And I was like, as long as I can just stay calm, stay where I'm at, I'm like, they won't be tipped off. And so that's how I was able to keep my composure and keep them from basically cracking me. But yeah, it was tough. It was not fun. And you'll see if you read the forum of my book, and like I said, if you got my message, I'm sorry I didn't send it, but I will. My best friend was like, you know, Jody will never lie to you. He goes, there's been times I wish he would have lied. And, you know, it was at that moment where I got sick of lying to the cops that I was like, you know, I gave lying up. Now, I won't tell the whole truth sometimes, but I won't lie.
How long was it before you did admit to the sexual contact?
Let's see. So if I flew home March 1st, probably went to the sheriff's office March 2nd, and the police report didn't come back till March 9th. And that was 1 week before Jeff was to be returned home to Baton Rouge. So you're looking at, you know, a week. And my mother told me the night before, she said, Mike Burnett called me and he wants to come over tomorrow to talk to me. And I don't know why. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, the hospital report came back. Well, that day I got off of the school bus. My mother was sitting at the bus stop waiting for me. And she told my brother, you need to just go play. I need to talk to Jody. So she took me home. She sat me down. And she said, Mike Burnett came over today. And again, I'm thinking, okay, this is the time where I'm going to have to fess up. And she said, the hospital report came back positive. And I pretended to play dumb. I knew what she meant. And I said, well, what does that mean? And she just looked at me and she goes, that means Jeff was fooling with you. And I said, yeah, he did. I admitted it. And so it was at that moment where, like I said, the police were wrong on both occasions. I wasn't that brainwashed where I did admit it. And something had happened to me. And they had, I mean, I have a copy of the hospital report where it says, you know, spermatozoa present on rectal slide. And somebody on Facebook, it shows up on Facebook like every other week on my feed. And someone was like, well, I know someone who was related to Jeff and there's more to the story. I'm like, let me tell you something. I don't care if there's more to the story. And I posted a picture of that rape report. And I said, being caught across the country with a 10-year-old boy with your DNA in his backside, that's not a good look. So that person never responded back to me. So they're trying to take up for Jeff, saying that he never did it and that was a lie. And the police, it wasn't a lie. Jeff was a scumbag, child molester, pedophile, child rapist, right, and pretty much got what he deserved. 28 million people viewing his death on YouTube.
Yeah. Well, let's get to that point, because again, I remember this taking place, and of course they didn't show the full graphic nature of the video, just the beginnings of it, and I remember being shocked by what I saw, but I completely empathized with the situation. So let's talk about this. He's taken into custody. And had he been processed and found guilty yet? What was going on at this point that he's in the airport? Can you lead us up to that moment before what happens next?
Sure. Okay. So we're in LA. We're Anaheim. He gets arrested. He refuses extradition for a couple of weeks. So it took 2 weeks roughly before two guys from the Baton Rouge Sheriff's Department flew out to California to bring him back. Bud Connors and Mike Burnett. And Mike Burnett is the one that yelled, "Why, Gary, why?" So they got to California and they give Jeff the option. Like, do you want to fly back? Do you want to drive back? You know, we're prepared to do whatever you want. Jeff said, you know, we can fly. Well, Mike and Bud told me this story, you know, years later, but it's kind of funny. The FBI guy said, look, man, you can't crack this guy. He won't talk. And they said, all right. So Mike is driving the rental car back to the rental car place, and the FBI guy is driving Jeff and Bud to the airport. And immediately Jeff asked Bud if he was Catholic. Bud said, yeah, cause he had like a St. Christopher like medal on his neck. And immediately Jeff starts crying and confessing, and they weren't even to the airport yet. Jeff didn't confess to molesting three kids, crying. And Bud looks at the FBI guy and goes, boy, yeah, he's tough, because the guy's like, oh, he's tough. You can't crack him. And so the whole way home, Jeff's crying, confessing to molesting me and two other boys. And meanwhile, he's lying while he's confessing, because he said it only occurred on like 10 occasions, even though it occurred for 10 months straight. So, you know, he confessed. They fly back to Baton Rouge. And my dad had said, when they told my dad, because they told my dad and my mother at the same time about Jeff molesting me, my dad said, he's a dead MF. Like, he's like, I'm going to kill him. Like most parents would do.
Right.
And so before Mike Burnett went out to California, my mother was worried about daddy. And Mike Burnett told my mother, June, I've been protecting prisoners long before Gary decided to become a hitman or an assassin. And so Mike Barnett was, you know, aware that my dad had made these threats, but, you know, he felt he could get Jeff home safely.
And he probably heard these kind of threats before.
Yes, absolutely. And if you watch the video from beginning, you see Mike walk out first, and you see Mike looking behind the camera because some people had gathered behind the camera to see, ooh, what's about to happen. And so Mike walks out, and he scans the concourse of the airport.
Okay, well, hold on 1 second. 1 second. Before we get to that point, I want to talk a little bit about your dad, if you don't mind, leading up to this. He's undoubtedly twisted by what has happened to his son, and wants revenge, like any parent would want. But how does he get that opportunity? Can you kind of walk us through the moments that led him to this life-altering situation?
Sure. All right. First off, when my dad was younger, my dad worked for WBRZ Channel 2. He was a cameraman. That's the news station that videotaped the shooting. So my dad also hung out at a restaurant called the Cotton Club. You know, they had their little bar area he would sit at, and that's where he would entertain his clients and have lunch. And my dad would brag that he got in the last fight at the old Cotton Club and the first fight at the new Cotton Club. And that was about a half a mile up the street from Channel 2. My dad bowled with the people from Channel 2 because he knew all the behind-the-scenes people and the front-of-the-scenes people. Like, so my dad knew all the people at this news station. That's why if you see the footage of me returning home, Channel 2 was in New Orleans recording my coming home from California. So Channel 2 was just doing a follow-up story. Well, there was a guy at Channel 2 who's a program director named Bob Shadell. It was a Friday, and that Friday, Bob Shadell asked my dad, hey, when are they bringing Doucette back? And Daddy said, I don't know. They won't tell me. I think he's back already. And Bob Shadell said, no, he's not back. Bob Shadell got up, went to the payphone, called Channel 2, or called the Sheriff's Department, whichever one, and asked, when is Doucette arriving back? They told him 9 o'clock. So Bob Shadell went to my dad and said, he'll be back in tonight at 9 o'clock. Now, did Bob Shadell think Daddy was going to do what he did? No. Did he try to create a news story? In my opinion, absolutely. So that's when my dad was torn. And he also was talking to my mother, who I was talking to. But I told my mother, don't tell Daddy what, like, the details of what had happened. And Daddy became obsessed with whether Jeff made me perform oral sex on him or not. And that's all he wanted to know. And only, like, on three occasions did he make me do that. You know, once I threw up, and then he quit. So my mother had told him, yeah. Well, for whatever reason, that was too much. And he went back and forth. And he actually drove out to False River, which is a lake about 45 minutes from my house. It's, you know, not far from Baton Rouge. And then he turned his car around and he went back to the airport. He had taken the gun from the house the night before, and he had the gun put in his boot. So if you see the video, you'll see his right pant leg is up to where he reached in his boot and grabbed his gun. And so when he got to the airport, he still – and people go, oh, it was premeditated. I promise you, if it was premeditated, my dad wasn't that good at planning things. It wouldn't have gone off as perfectly as it did. But my dad was actually talking on the phone to his friend. Mike Barnett came out. Daddy didn't see Jeff. Daddy told his friend. He said, well, they must have taken him out back because I see Mike, but I don't see Jeff. Well, Jeff and Bud were waiting down the concourse, the corridor, so Mike could kind of scope out the place. So Mike's looking around, and he doesn't see anybody. And he waves them. He says, all right, come on. And if you watch the video again, you can see Jeff and Bud talking. And Bud's telling Jeff, you know, if you see anybody hit the ground, you know, just, you know, keep your head up and keep looking. And you can see Jeff and Bud kind of looking behind the camera to see if they see anybody. No one ever looked to the right. And, again, if you pay attention to the video, that wall – where the payphones were, it was indented. So they really couldn't see unless they turned their head to the right to look, which they never thought about doing. And my dad used the lights of the camera. So when the camera lights came parallel to him, that's when he knew to turn around. So he turned around, and when he did, he looked up. Jeff was right there, put the gun up, underneath his arm holding the phone, pulled the trigger, and I'm willing to bet Jeff never heard the shot.
Yeah, the your father pulled the gun, shot Jeff in the head. It appears in the video that he sets the gun down and then just kind of immediately surrenders as the cops cry out, "Why? Why, Gary? Why?" And they pin him to the wall and begin cuffing him.
That was Mike.
Right. And your father was very calm through all of this. I mean, it was, even though this was not, in a sense, it's premeditated, but it was a spur of the moment emotional deal. Once he knew that this guy was going to be there, he knew what he wanted or had to do, and took it upon himself to end Doucette's life. Do you remember hearing that news, and how did that impact you?
So normally, when I was that age, I would watch the news at night and then I'd go to bed. This particular night, I was tired for whatever reason, probably because, you know, I'd been kidnapped. And so I went to bed and I woke up the next morning and Daddy wasn't there. It was his weekend to have us. So my grandparents picked us up and brought us out to the lake, out to Falls River, and Daddy wasn't there. And my grandparents were stone-faced and quiet. And they were saying, "All right, get up. We're going back to Baton Rouge. We're going back to Baton Rouge." And they wouldn't tell us why we were going back to Baton Rouge. And so I'm in my head, I'm thinking, okay, Daddy didn't show up. I thought Daddy had gotten like in a wreck, maybe, or something had happened to Daddy, because his parents were kind of freaked out and we were going back to Baton Rouge. Never in Daddy shot you. And so we go to my grandparents' house, and my mother shows up with my uncle. My uncle worked for the sheriff's department, too, so they're riding a police car, a unit. And when my mother showed up with my uncle, I knew something very bad had happened, still not knowing what it was. And my mother had us four kids on the steps of my grandparents' house, and she said, "Last night, Jeff came back from California, and when he did, Daddy shot him." Now, in my head, think of like the presidents when they get off the plane, they get them steps. And so I'm thinking Jeff's coming down the steps when Daddy shot him on the tarmac of the airport, not knowing that you got off and came to the airport inside. And so they told me not to look at the paper and not to look at the news because it was on video. So the first thing I did was I went and got a paper and I watched the news because I wanted to see it. My initial reaction was I was upset that Jeff was dead. Or was about to die, because at this point, I don't think he was officially declared dead. But I was mad at what Daddy had done. I wasn't happy with Daddy, and I was upset that Jeff was shot.
It's remarkable, right? I mean, your first initial reaction, "Oh my God, my friend is dead." And that your dad did this, what a mixed bag of strange emotions that had to be for you.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was, like I said, I mean, I felt like I lost my best friend. I remember coming home and going back behind the fence. We have a fence in our backyard and just kind of getting away. Cause you know, at this point, everyone's over at the house. I mean, you had people all over bringing food, you know, telling me, "Oh, your dad did this for you." And I'm like, you know, and he didn't ask my permission. This is not what I wanted. And I just remember going behind the fence and sitting back there for about an hour and just crying and just thinking like, you know, why, you know, this is crazy. And I went back, there's a pharmacy. There used to be a pharmacy back there. And I went back there and the pharmacist's name was James. He owned the store. And, you know, he just said, you know, your thoughts and prayers are with me or whatever. And I saw the news and I just wanted to get away. And when I got back to the house, my brother was like, "Come on, let's go to Shay's house. He's got a swing." They had this big tree swing. And I went down there and I was able to kind of forget about everything and go play with my peers. And that meant a lot because, you know, I was able to escape the reality of what was going on.
Now, once your father did this, he's taken into custody. What eventually happened with your father?
right, so he shot him on a Friday night. He couldn't post bail till Monday morning. He got out Monday morning, and they immediately, I think he went to his friend's house for a day or two, and they put him into a psychiatric clinic for to be evaluated. And he probably was at that place for a month, and they released him, and then he came back home. So my parents had separated in July. This is March, and they got back together. And so Daddy's now back in the house. He was told he couldn't drink. My mother said, if he don't drink, he's welcome back. So he's back in the house. And over the next several months, it was almost like a slow, gradual progression into getting back to how our life was before we started taking karate. So by the time the end of that summer came, I had gotten back into playing baseball. Daddy was back in the house. And I had kind of accepted him back in my life because Jeff didn't want me, you know, around him. And we kind of got back to normal. Well, then, you know, it's on the news every day. Eventually, my dad had to fire his initial lawyer because that lawyer wouldn't accept a plea deal. And the DA was offering my dad a plea deal that would he would serve no jail time. Well, his attorney had signed an agreement to do a book and a movie deal, but it only was only if it went to trial. So he wouldn't accept that plea deal, which was crazy because they were offering no jail time. But my dad's lawyer figured they weren't going to convict my dad of shooting and killing the guy who had kidnapped and molested his son. And Mike Barnett says that in the ESPN documentary, not in Baton Rouge, they weren't going to do it. They wouldn't do it now. People tell me, oh, well, if your dad did that now, he would go to jail. I tell people, you know what? My dad not only didn't go to jail, he didn't lose his job, and he drove the company car to the airport. So eventually he hired a new lawyer. He pled no contest to manslaughter and was sentenced to 7 years prison, suspended with 5 years probation and 300 hours of community service.
How was your relationship with your family after all of this shook out?
By the time, you know, my dad had pled no contest, and I mean, like I said, I was back into sports. I was back. I mean, it was almost like you could take that section of our lives, remove it, and put it back how it was before. I mean, despite everything that we had gone through, I think we got back to as normal as you could possibly consider normal.
It's a remarkable story. Can you tell us, I know we don't have much time left together, Jody, but what are signs that parents should be looking out for if their children might be molested and, like you, unable or unwilling to come forward?
Besides the obvious, you know, like if a kid comes up with an STD, that, you know, or let's say they have like some type of blood. I never had that, but let's say, you know, they have blood. And like let's say a little girl might complain about a stomach ache when it's actually some type of genital trauma. But the one sign that I tell people that to me is the most obvious one is that if a grown up or if anyone wants to spend more time with your child than you do, that's not just a red flag. That is a rocket. Because, you know, I've spent time with my nephew. I took him to his first LSU basketball game, but I didn't volunteer to do it. My brother called me and said, hey, look, can you bring Dylan to his Little League basketball game? You know, I have to bring the other kids to the soccer. My wife has to go to this tournament. And so I agreed to do it. But I never had called my brother and said, hey, do you need me to pick Dylan up at soccer? So in order for a child molester to molest a child, they have to get the child alone. And so, like I said, if someone wants to spend more time with your kid than you do, then that's the biggest red flag I think that's out there.
And how long did it take for you to kind of get your life back? I know you said you kind of felt like that piece had just been removed, but, you know, obviously there was a healing process for you. And have you ever really felt complete again?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I would say maybe the end of the summer. I remember me and my dad, we were walking down to the swimming pool, and this was at night. And I just kind of remember telling him, okay, I forgive you, and I understand why you did what you did. So I would say by the end of the summer, I'd kind of gotten back to where I felt not lonely or sad or any of that, to where I understood what my father did and welcomed him back into my life.
If you could have the ears of children right now that were in your situation, so that maybe this isn't an interview in total that our listeners will share with their kids, but as somebody who survived something like this, what advice would you give to children that find themselves in your situation?
Well, I used to go under the theory of, you know, if anyone ever touches you inappropriate, you want to tell a grown-up that you know and trust. But I want to talk to the parents. I want to tell the parents, keep an eye on your children and don't let your children go around people. And now, again, it's someone you know and trust. You know, if try not to let your children go alone with anybody. I don't want to put the responsibility of not being molested on a child. I want the parent, the adult, to have that responsibility to keep the child from being molested. But if I am talking to the children, you know, if anyone ever touches you in a way that makes you feel uncomfortable, I don't care whether it's touching your private parts or whether it's, you know, kissing you on the cheek, you don't have to do it, or tell your parents that you don't want to do it. And I'm telling the parents to listen, want to hug Uncle Paul because he's creepy, then don't make your child hug Uncle Paul. Another thing that parents do is, hey, get up and let Uncle Paul sit down. Well, how about Uncle Paul follow another seat? You know, children grow up in this world, and Jim Clemente, who's a former FBI profile, he talks about grow up in this world of giants, to where, you know, somehow an adult has more rights than you. And when you tell a kid, get up and let this grown-up sit down, what message are you sending to them? It's, they have to kind of conform to what this grown-up wants. So I want the adults to know to be more responsible when it comes to protecting your children.
That's great advice. Jody, thank you for coming on to share your story and your father's story, and hopefully giving some insight to people out there and to survivors to see that what occurred in your life doesn't define who you are and that you can rise above it. Do you feel like you are on a good, healthy, steady path for yourself in life?
Oh, absolutely. When I was 18, I went on the Geraldo Rivera talk show, and I looked at it as a trip to New York, a free trip to New York. And I went on the show, me and Daddy talked about what happened. And a couple weeks later, after it aired, I got a call from Mike Barnett, and he said, look, we just arrested this pastor who had been molesting these two kids. And the one kid came forward after seeing you on the Geraldo show. And so it was at that moment that I realized that sharing my story can help people. And even my book came out at the end of August, which it's available on Amazon, Why Gary Why. And I've had people not necessarily tell me, but text a friend, and the friend would show me the text talking about, I've read Jody's book and it's made me kind of reconsider some of the things that happened in my life. And so I think I'm on a good path. I'm going to continue to try to spread the word. I'm going to continue to speak out. I've got some speaking engagements coming up here over the next couple of months. I'd love to book many more. I think I got a positive message, and it will let people know that you can go through something as tragic as this, and you could come out on the other side and be okay. And that's the message that I always share, is that with the proper support, you can get through most tragedies. I mean, obviously, if you get killed, you can't. But, you know, with the proper support, you can come out being okay.
We've got the link for Jody's book on today's program. You can find that order the book, rate and review the book as well, so that this story gets out there and more people can hear about it. Jody, thank you so much for spending your time with us today and sharing your story.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm going to send you that digital copy. I'm sorry I didn't do it before.
No problem, sir. Thank you. And thank you all for tuning in. Talk to your children. Let them know they're safe. Don't threaten that you will kill the people responsible, because that may keep your children from ever opening up to you completely. I know that we want to feel like those superheroes, that our children can feel like we've got their back. You can do that in other ways, simply by assuring them that it's okay that they could come to you and that they will be safe, you will be safe, everyone will be safe. So please bear that in mind when dealing with your children going forward. We'll be back again next week with more of the best in True Crime Talk Radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This is True Crime Tuesday.